Rock to Recovery Radio on KX93.5 FM, Laguna's only FM station, Human Crafted Radio. I am your host, Wesley Gear, and my guest can see me closing my eyes because I'm really trying to remember what the heck to say because I forgot. I just woke up from a nap.
That's all right.
Is it okay?
That's all right.
Thank you, man. Mm-hmm. So this is...
I just woke up from a 10-year nap. So.
Oh, wow, woke up from man. That's impressive.
That's right.
One of those.
Yeah.
So we're Rock to Recovery Radio. I cannot speak. And why are we here? We do this show each week. Well, I'm a sober guy, and I'm really passionate about recovery. I didn't die. Somehow, people showed me a way to stop killing myself with drugs, alcohol, and all this crazy behaviors. And like a lot of us, when you do that, you kind of get passionate about helping others. And then I think for anybody, even if they're not suffering addiction or mental health or something like that, we all know somebody or have a loved one or a friend who's suffering or has suffered or who's died. We lose people all the time. And I'm not trying to be Debbie Downer, but gosh, this is a serious thing we're dealing with. We lose stars and friends and brothers and sisters and mothers and fathers all the time. So we have this show to create an open forum to talk about not just the problem, but the solution, which is the key. And each week we interview rock stars, celebrities, in this case, comedians, or just rad humans. And we chronicle their story through the, you know, near-death experiences, the gates of hell and making it out and how they did it. And the key thing, though, that I think that we talk about is not just how bad it was, but how good it gets. Something I call the vortex of radness. Because I think for a lot of us, when we're in those dark spots, whether you're a wounded vet or a heroin junkie or a victim of abuse, you feel like life can never get good again. But we hear these stories from people who felt that very same feeling, the hopelessness, the darkness, and then somehow they made it out. How? Because we do this together. We do it by talking about it. We do it by sharing. And in so doing, we realize that we're not terminally unique. There is a way out. And we love to help. So my guest tonight, I think that was good enough.
Yeah, that
about
was about
17 minute
nice.
Intro.
It was good. No, it was good. It was good.
Thanks, man.
You know what you're listening to. If you wanted something else, go somewhere else. But
right.
you set the tone nicely.
Good. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, it's good.
Thank you. So, you know, yeah, you can go over and check something else out if you want.
Yeah.
So my guest tonight, super cool guy. I met him through this holiday show we did for Rock to Recovery and through some common friends we have. But his story is, and I probably only know a very small, no, I know I only know a very small portion, so I'll give you the little nuggets that I do know.
Yeah.
Writer, helped write some Sex in the City stuff.
Yeah, it was right? Yeah, it was a consultant there. Yep.
And also, he's just not that into you. Is that correct?
That's right. He's just not that into you.
Which went into a movie.
Which became a movie later on.
Yeah. Became a movie. And you've been a comedian for a long time.
Yeah,
and a writer.
Almost 30 years.
Yep. 30 years. Yep. And I got to see your act at our holiday show. It was the first time. And you were just amazing. I love it. Very funny guy. And sober dude.
Yeah.
Hence being on the show. And on top of that, cancer survivor.
Yes. Ugh. Yes, and not to brag or throw more credits out there, but I am having my hip replaced tomorrow.
Dang, dude.
Tomorrow morning at four o'clock in the morning.
You're gonna be bionic.
Yeah, I'm gonna have it. Yeah. I'm gonna have a titanium hip. So that's
wow.
A groovy thing for a 55-year-old. This
yeah, year. Go for it.
20
dude.
Years, 20 years ahead of the ahead of the curve.
And you know it's cool. I can now announce you, but also tie in your new nickname, which is Greg Bionic. Barron.
Greg Bionic Barron.
Yeah, there he
total
is.
Total actual hipster. And
literally.
Literally a hipster.
Wow.
Yeah, literally a hipster. So I've had, I have that to look forward to, and also something that most people wouldn't be grateful for, but I'm actually grateful for the, for the diagnosis to know what it is, and then B, that there's a solution.
That there's technology. Yeah.
And it's like my doctor said, man, you're lucky it's not your knee. I didn't know that there was a better thing to have, but sorry if you have a bad knee.
Yeah.
You know?
And glad it's not you.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. That's cool. I mean, as things go, we don't like to do any of this kind of stuff, but the hip seems to be one Well, put it this way. You'd rather do that than probably battle cancer again, eh?
Yes. Yeah. Any day of the week. Any day of the week. All of it. I mean, yeah, it's just the life stuff. Yeah.
So thanks for coming down here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I'm so blessed to have an amazing human here like you. You got your dad, Dick Barron.
I brought
here
my dad
as well.
With me, Dick Barron. Yeah, that's right.
Super cool dude.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I really appreciate you coming down here because I know when I talk to, without the radio show, just to my friends, hey, you want to come down to Laguna? They're like, oh, it's like Afghanistan. It's like, well, maybe not.
It is. It's not quite as. If you look at, and if you're in Afghanistan, don't take that personally. It's a hard place to get to, is what you're saying.
That's what I meant, it's a tough road.
Yeah. Anytime anybody says, "Do you want to come?" If you're up in the Hollywood, Los Angeles area, and anyone suggests that you might want to come, you know, the way of the orange, you're like, "Ah, oh, man, is that something I have to do?" But I actually love it. I like the drive. I do very well in the Irvine. Improv. I've had nothing but really good experiences down here.
Cool.
I have a few friends that live in Laguna, so I don't equate this with being a big problem.
Good. Thanks for coming.
Yeah, no, I was happy to do it. Also, anytime you have to do radio on the phone or like a Skype, that stuff just is, what's the point?
It doesn't feel good, does it?
No, yeah. No.
And some people are watching a Facebook Live or Instagram Live, but the people who aren't can't see how intimately close we are. I mean, we're close.
We're super close.
If we were on a date, if you were my date, I'd be like, oh, it's getting good right
now. Yeah, right. Right. The only person I've ever sat closer to is Oprah.
Ooh.
When I did her show, and we were knee to knee. I didn't realize how, you know, you think, oh, that looks so huge, but they put you right there. And if she stays close to you, you're doing well. When she doesn't, in the old days, if you want to know that she liked a guest or not, as soon as she sat back, you were done. She was like, you're not coming back. Sat back like this. Mm. You know, but if she liked you, she'd pat your knee.
The back of death.
Yeah.
So did you get a lot of knee pats?
She has a lot of them.
Did you count them?
Yeah.
Like 13?
It was, you know, there was one every segment. So, you know, there was like four or five solid.
That's solid.
Knee pats, yeah.
Huh. I wonder if there's some sort of rating thing out there, like how many knee pats you get from Oprah, you know.
Right. And I mean, I'm probably up there.
I think so.
I'm up there.
I'm going to say you're top 2%.
Yeah. For
Why
sure.
not?
For
Nothing
sure.
but the best. So let's get into it.
Yeah,
know?
Sure.
What we do is the kind of like what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And now check out this wrinkle is Dad's here, and which is rad, 100% rad, 1,000% even. But what I always ask people is like, where does the story start? Because sometimes childhoods can be tough, and we don't blame anything on our childhood. But where does your story start?
Well, I would say, I would definitely say that it started in my childhood. But I am always wary to blame either of my parents because as I recall it, I remember very young being much harder on myself than either of my parents were. I mean, I took life incredibly personally. My dad and I used to play this game called, what was it called, Rolo. And literally, you would roll dice and then knock off the numbers. And whoever got the numbers done first won. It was a game of chance. And I would lose, and I would lose my mind. And I'd be like, why?
Seven?
Why?
Mother Mary of God, why?
I mean, I remember him being like, dude, it's just chance. It's a game of chance.
Yeah.
Like, I really did feel like I was being picked on, or I was, why can't I win? Like, it's seven. And so I think...
did you ever think Dad was cheating, maybe?
It would have been hard. It would have been really hard to cheat at dice where he's just throwing
them. Could have been loaded.
I don't feel like he needed to win that. For him, that was it would have been great if I won. I think he was pulling for me to win so he didn't have a meltdown.
Yeah.
So I was very sensitive, I think, early on. And I also had learning disabilities and those kinds of things. So I had trouble keeping up, and I just assumed I was stupid and, you know, that kind of stuff. So I had a story going early on, and and that made me, it made it difficult for me to do sports, and it made it difficult with school. And the first time that I remember getting drunk or like that, I remember feeling like, oh, that anxiety just go away.
Mm.
And suddenly I felt like, and I was pretty funny, and I was, I found myself pretty articulate and able to talk, and people seemed to enjoy me. They seemed to enjoy me as a drunk person. And I thought, well, there you go.
There you go.
And it's something it seemed to do well, you know?
Yeah.
So that was really sort of how it started.
Yeah.
You know?
So seven, you're struggling at dice game.
Right. I'm struggling at dice at seven. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. A lot of tantrums.
Yeah. And what else before you picked up the drink? Was there any other significant stuff like emotionally or, you know, being picked on or just not like fitting in? What was some of the childhood stuff like?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was sort of it. Like as a, you know, I'm 55. So, you know, the sort of demarcation point for most dudes was like, are you good at sports? And if you're not good at sports, then you need to go where the other dudes are. And I wanted to be good at sports and I just didn't have the hand-eye coordination for baseball. And
you were trying out and not making it.
Yeah, I would play. Yes.
Last to get picked.
That was happening, you know.
No, we're not taking Greg. You take him.
Yeah, there was a little bit of that. I mean, there was there would be crying during games. I mean, there were just some of those things. But somewhere around 7th, 8th grade, I got a tutor and I worked on my hand-eye coordination. And then I came back my 8th grade year and was able to hit the ball.
Nice.
So like, I can do things if I put the time in and I really work hard at it. And if I do work hard at it, I will be good at it. But it will take longer than other people.
It's a lot harder, yeah.
So I had to like sort of – I didn't really quite get that till later on in life that like my pace is just different. That's it.
And that's
I have the aptitude. I just need I need to go at my pace. And that's hard. When you're in a school, like schools go a certain – everything goes at a certain speed. And
one
you're
size
not
fits
in,
all. Doesn't
that's
it?
Right.
Yeah.
And or they will put you in a class where you were like – I was in like what they – you remember the Sweat Hawk? Welcome back,
yeah,
Potter. I was in that class. I would get in. I was in that class of like these are the not just delinquents, but people we don't know what to do with because we don't have names for the ADD or AHD or whatever it is. You know,
they tried to create a diagnosis for it, didn't they?
Right. They were like, they just were like, put him just over there.
Was Cotter's class, Mr. Cotter, was that a like
learning disability?
Was it
derelicts?
I didn't pick up on that because I was too young. But
yeah,
it was.
Yeah.
Okay, so
the Sweat Hogs were like a special class in the school for
Mr. Cotter.
Yeah.
I get that, and not to go too deep off on a tangent, but you know, you got let's say a young guy. 10 years old and he's not paying attention to school. It's like, hey, let's give him Ritalin or Adderall or whatever. It's like, maybe he's just a young boy that kind of spazzes out. Cause I had the same thing. I didn't like school. I found it easy if I wanted to apply myself, but I just wasn't into it at all. And, you know, flunked out, got kicked out of school and whatever, but it doesn't mean look at us now.
Right.
Well,
I have to say it takes a while to know why you're learning anything. So I have two daughters and both of them are pretty good in school. But I'm always trying to give them context for why they would want to know something. And also, like, you don't have to know this forever. We just need to get through this together. You know, you'll take what you need and move on. But
yeah,
but this is just a test of your ability to remember things. And it is not about your quality as a human being. If you can look at it as a sort of separate thing and then we can figure out how to get through it, you know, that's fine. But I don't care whether you like history or not. If you do, great. If you do not, but I don't think, you know, given what there was to do in the world, you know, the world's different now. So why you would learn something and why you would need to know it are different than back then. It was just there were jobs that you would have or jobs that you wouldn't. I'm not going to be a teacher. I'm not going to be a lawyer. I'm not going to be a doctor. Now rock and roll was not really a thing that was available to people. Like it was, you know, anybody that had a guitar, to me, that was almost like owning a gun. Like guys that had guitars were, you know, when I was in high school, were like guys that lived on the edge a little bit. Like they were truly. Yeah, there was like two guys that had electric guitars when I was in grammar school. And I was like, those guys are messed up. They are messed
crazy.
Up.
Yeah, man. I get that. Yeah.
So messed up.
So tell me about, what age were you? Do you remember your first drink? What brought it on? What made it happen? How it went down?
The first one was – well, the first drink I think was in the basement of my house. I took some – my parents had a party and there were some warm, tall Budweisers.
Mm.
And me and
how old were you?
Probably 11 or 12 maybe, something like that.
So they had a party.
They had a party, and there was a couple of Budweisers downstairs, and me and my buddy Greg drank one, and it was okay. It was all right, you know. Like I remember, like it wasn't like an event, but that was like the first time. But the first time I remember drinking, like it having effect, was at a party at a friend's house down the street.
When you stole that first Budweiser, right, or whatever you did, what did you have any? Did you know why you're drinking it? What did was were people drinking like, oh, that looks cool? Or
I always thought I looked cool.
Did you know you were doing it to change the way you feel? Some people actually say they did at an early age.
No,
No.
Not really. I mean, I got a sense of it, yeah. But I just felt like it felt dangerous. I mean, it could have been smoking a cigarette.
Yeah.
It could have been anything. It just felt like this is, A, we're not supposed to.
Yeah.
And B, it seems cool. Yeah. And the people that I like do it, and they're cool.
And Budweiser was cool
And Budweiser was cool. Yeah. And it was a tall, it was the early, it was like tall cans were new.
Oh, yeah.
They also had the really shorty ones, too. And, and so I think that was sort of the, was just the idea of being cool.
That was the allure of it.
Yeah.
So then you're at a party and then you drank. And
then I drank a few of them and it was at somebody else's house. And I just remember going, wow, this is nice.
You're like,
I'm talking to girls. I mean, I don't know that they're interested, but here I am standing in front of them talking and I'm hilarious. And I don't know. I just felt okay. I think.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I can relate. Girls are a big part of it for me, too, because I was very shy, late bloomer, you know. Guys are shaving. I wasn't. And then, but the drinking was like a great equalizer for me and talking to women. That was a big...
That was always my obsession. I mean, even as a very, very... I mean, that's another thing I remember very, very, very young, like being aware of women and being fascinated with all aspects of them, mm-hmm. Just watching them, just being around mm-hmm. them, just like what their world... And I always thought, this is where... I need to be there.
Yeah.
That's my, you know, I mean, and that was always sort of the thing. That, I mean, when people go, what was your hobby? I go, well, what did I think about all the time? I mean, my hobby, I mean, did I like Star Wars? Until I got a car. Like, yeah. I really did sort of most of the things that I wanted to do, like football, and even when I started playing music and that stuff was, oh, there'll be girls maybe at the end of
this. Yeah. Interesting. You know?
Yeah, so that was a big part of the drive.
Yeah, I totally get that. So where'd the drinking go after your first drink? It felt good. Were you seeking it more? When did you start?
I mean, I felt like I fell in with a group of people that did it, you know, like together. It happened, you know, it happened at parties. I mean, it was never by myself. It was always with friends and, you know, sometimes we'd get really, I mean, at the beginning, you're just experimenting, grabbing stuff and trying it. So you're throwing up a lot.
That's a lot.
You know, part of it is you're drinking too much. But part of it is you're just like, you just drank like plum wine and you're like, what? And gin. Like we just mixed those.
Yeah.
You know, I remember going to.
But taking a sip isn't going to make you vomit. You're obviously trying to a large scale.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. You're drinking more than, I mean, you don't know what you're drinking. Nobody's explained any of it to you. Like there was no, you know, just like with sex and with a lot of things, there was no course in it. Nobody had any like don't and be careful and you shouldn't. But that was it. And so, you know, you're with buddies and you've got like warm gin and guava juice and you're mixing that. And then you're going to see an Eddie Murphy movie. And the next thing you know, they're walking you out because you've thrown up on the people in front of you. Like you just don't quite.
Did that happen?
Yeah. Yeah. So it was 48 hours.
So how old were you then?
Whenever 48 Hours came out, I was probably in high school, I think.
Yeah. So you're in high school, you went out drinking, went into a movie. Did you black out?
Yes.
You blacked out?
Yeah, I don't think I drove. Maybe. I'm pretty fairly certain I didn't.
But we really don't know because we established you were in a blackout.
That's right. That's right. We don't know.
So next thing you know what? Your friends are walking out. You're like, hey, what are you doing? And they said, you just vomited on some people?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that happened a few times. Not just in high school. I mean, it would happen a few
vomiting
times
on people in theaters or just in general.
At a Simple Minds concert, that was a good one. That was the one where, so I drove.
Yeah.
And we drank in the city. I lived in Marin County, which is where I grew up.
Okay.
We went into San Francisco, and I had a '79 Ford Bronco that plays into a lot of my story.
Oh,
but
sick.
It was great with my parents letting me have it, and I totally disrespected it. And so my friends threw me in the back of the car. Like they took me out of the concert and dumped me in the back mm-hmm. part of the, it was, you know, and then drove home and then left the car on my driveway. They picked up their own car and then they went home.
Just
so they
left
me in the car. So the Bronco only had two doors in the front. So I had to climb out of the back up to the front. And as I was getting out, I fell out of the car and I knocked myself out. So now it appears that I've driven the car because I've come out the passenger side. I'm laying on the ground in the driveway, and the dog, we had two golden retrievers, and they were running in a circle barking, and I can just vaguely remember my dad picking me up by the collar, right, like I remember seeing his face, and then I was asleep, and then this is who my parents were. So I came out in the morning, and there was a plate at our table, and there was a piece of concrete on it, and my mom said something to the effect of, I just thought maybe you wanted to finish what you had started eating last night.
Oh, my God.
Which was the pavement. So my parents were funny. But, yeah, so that was sort of, you know. And those things, you know, it's interesting. Like, that stuff would happen, but then would be a long space before anything like that would happen again. You know, like, it would be...
I like how they did that with the comedy aspect. Kind of like, you know, yeah, that's good. That's a good way to spin it, I think.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, you know, right, because, I mean, what are you going to... Like, there's only so much... It's already happened.
Yeah, it's happened.
Right,
yeah.
I've already fallen out of the car, and, you know, hopefully it's never going to happen again. Maybe, you know.
Huh. I can relate. I can relate to this. This is good. This reminds me a lot of myself.
But I also didn't have any... There was no... I didn't... I was... You know, like, people sometimes talk about, like, they were already sad, and it was already hard, and they had, you know, like a... I don't remember it not being okay. You know, like, I don't remember thinking, okay, well, I mean, that happened, but it doesn't happen all the time, and I'm still right. moving through life in the same direction that life is going. I'm going to college, and I'm going to, you know...
No reason to quit, just a mishap.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Right. And also, like, I, you know, I grew up in a time when people drank lots. I mean, adults drank lots, and so, you know...
70s.
Yes, 60s, 70s, you know, and into the 80s, you know, and it just, it was, you know, we don't start really, it doesn't really start becoming a thing that people talk about till I get out of college. I mean, really, you know, I mean, when I was a kid, it was like, you just didn't get mentioned. People got institutionalized all the time for being crazy, but mostly they were just being thrown in there because they were alcoholic and they needed to dry out, right?
That's a good point. I didn't think about that. Yeah, true. Yeah. So when does it start getting bad? That sounds like, you know, my brother had similar escapades, you know, vomiting on the stairs after a night of drink. You know, when it just as a kid experimenting, and he's not one of us. But where does it turn the corner for you?
Not until I mean, I wrote it. Hey, it's funny. It's the way you retell your story. So, you know, like I like to joke that, like, you know, there's a guy that I am when I'm drunk that I enjoy. Mm-hmm. Because he knows how to get things done. Mm-hmm. He meets people, he makes friends, travels. I go, I started in Santa Monica and I woke up in the desert. That guy knows how to motivate himself.
How would I do that?
Right. Look at that. I woke up in a whole other place. Mm-hmm. I'd wake up with, you know, furniture, things I'd brought home, you know, not necessarily always people. Like one time I came home, I had 4 traffic cones I'd laid out on my bed. Like I was a collector. And I admire
the collector.
Right. And I, the one joke I make is I said, you know, one time I had taken some peyote because drugs are part of the story as well.
Sure.
And I was driving that Bronco. I was in college in Oregon. And when I came to, we were driving into the ocean. We were going straight. We were on the beach. We were headed for the ocean. Wow. Yeah. With 3 other guys who were not saying, nobody was saying stop. And what I joke around is, like, I mean, that's just leadership quality. Like, I got 3 guys to die with me. Like, I can't get 4 people to follow me on Instagram. So I feel like, in a way,
Thelma and Louise only had each other. You had a foursome.
That's right. And these guys were like, Barron's going in. There must be something to do on the bottom of that ocean floor because he's driving in and we're going with him.
Yeah.
And I do think there was something about the extroverted part of me and the fun part of me and the fact that I wasn't a guy who got in fights or a guy who got super sad till the end. You know, and that is a real part of me, of who I am, but I didn't know how to access it in any other way.
Yeah,
right? So
I get that.
You know,
somebody shared saying drinking was for me like spinach was for Popeye, and I kind of got that. Kind of gave me magic powers.
That's right. And a lot of my intentions were good, and I never had bad. You know, I never had. I mean, you know, certainly I've made some mistakes, but I never had stories where I'd hurt another human being.
Right.
Right. Like I had a lot of stories of doing damage and breaking things and acting like an idiot and that kind of thing, but I never. Got physical with anybody. I never became a beast of any kind in that way. So in
the DUIs,
there was a DUI, but it was the dumbest one. I was following a girl home because I didn't want to stay at her place, and she got pulled over, and I pulled over too because and the cop goes, "Why did you do this?"
And you're like, I'm asking myself that.
Oh my God. He goes, now I got to give you a breath test. What kind of an idiot are you? I'm like, I'm the biggest idiot. And that was how I got mine. But there were times where I qualified way more times than that. I qualified.
I hope that's in a comedy movie somewhere.
Just dumb. The guy goes, what are you wearing? I go, it was Valentine's Day. I had on like a coat. You got a nice coat and jacket, man. He goes, they're going to like you in the cell. And so then I spent a night at what they used to call the Blue Roof Inn, which is the jail up in
The
Blue Roof Inn.
I like it.
Up in Marin.
Well, this is great. I'm really enjoying this. Let's throw in a song here.
Yeah.
What song did we pick for your first one?
We take one of the 2 replacement songs, right? Here Comes a Regular? Oh, this is a beautiful song. This is called "Here Comes a Regular" by The Replacements. I like them because they were the archetype of the plan for me. They loved booze and they loved self defeat. No band, no group of men ever wanted it worse and hated themselves for it and made it fail better than them. And I was like, that seems cool.
Literally your theme song.
Yeah.
So this is Wes Skier on Rock to Recovery Radio here with Greg Barrett, comedian, writer, and this is The Replacements.
Much at all. The sun has passed, it's too late to cut the grass. There ain't much to break anyway in the fall. And sometimes I just ain't in the mood to chase my place and back for loud mouths. Like a picture on the fridge, it's never stocked with food. Used to live at home, now I stay at the house. And everybody wants to be special here. They call your name out loud and clear. I'll take a great big whiskey to you anyway. Everybody wants to be someone's here. Someone's gonna show up, never fear. Here comes a regular. I know is I'm sick of everything that my money can buy. A fool wastes his life, God rest his guts. First the lights and the collar goes up, the wind begins to blow. Turn your back on a pay your back last call. First the grass, and the leaves at last, here comes the snow. Ain't much to break anyway in the fall.
Wow. That
there's an uplifter.
Yeah, I was gonna
there's
say.
An uplifter. There you
well,
go.
Well, I want to go plant some flowers now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So that spoke to your soul. You got it.
Yeah, I mean, that was sort of, like I said, that band sort of represented what my take on life was, which is, you know, you, if you sell out, then you're an idiot, and you know, and only a true artist, you know, is in conflict with himself at all times.
Yeah.
Know? Which is not actually the case.
Yeah, I get
there's
that.
Plenty of successful artists who, you know, there's lots of different reasons to do stuff. So, but I really loved them, and they were a band that I followed around, and one of the, probably the first band that I went, oh, okay, I get these guys. I really get
resonate in you. And by the way, I got to do this really fast. This is Rock to Recovery Radio and KX935.com, Laguna's only FM. Also brought to you by New Vista Behavioral Health. They have great treatment programs out there if you're looking for health, help. New Vista Behavioral Health. We're here with Greg Barrett, writer, comedian, and problem drinker at this point.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah. When does it get bad? How do you hit your bottom?
When I was a senior in high school, I got a guitar and an Aerosmith record.
Which earlier was, you said
yeah, there was
people living on the edge or who get guitars.
Right, and then I finally got one, and my dad owned a couple of radio stations in the Pacific Northwest up in Oregon, and so I DJed.
Cool.
I
what kind of stations?
One was a rock station, one was a country station. And the rock station was in a dark, very David Lynch town called Coos Bay, which was a lumber town, and it was and so I worked at the rock station. I would do the overnights of it and learned how to, you know, and then I started, and that was my sort of entree into music. Because I'd been a jock all the way through high school and, you know, had records and that kind of stuff. But then I found an Aerosmith record and went, oh, God, I had no idea. Why was I in sports at all? I didn't know you could have scars and long hair and all that kind of stuff. So that sort of became my obsession. So I played music all the way through college, and I played, and I also got a theater degree, which is, you might, that's, don't, if you're getting one right now, please stop.
It's a waste of time.
Yeah, get something you can use later. You don't need to just go do a play or go audition, but you don't need a degree in it.
Yeah.
It's like hitting a, I'd have better luck if I brought a steering wheel to my, you know, as opposed to that, to, you know, a job interview, you know, at least people go, where'd you get the steering wheel?
Yeah.
You take it off out of your own car. Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, and I, went to San Francisco, didn't know what I was going to do, tried to be an actor. A friend of mine said, hey, you should try audition for this improv group. I did. I met a girl named Margaret Cho who was in the group, and she said, hey, you should do stand up. I started. I liked it. And I also played in a band. So,
did you have any desire to do stand up before? Because you talked about being funny when you're drinking. Did you fancy yourself a comedian ever?
Again, like my heroes, The Replacements, people would say, you should do comedy. I go, I'm not going to prostitute my personality for just to be on stage. Which is the dumbest thing anyone's ever said. It's like people are going, hey, you have a skill.
Yeah.
And it's not like you're amazing, but you have a skill. Why don't you apply that? And I'm like, I don't think so.
Don't exploit
me. I'm in a band. Yeah. And so, but I eventually did do it, and I found it success very quickly. And so after about 5 years, I played in a band, and I was doing both things, and I came down here, moved down to L.A., and
Go to L.A. trying to do a band rock thing?
Yeah.
Whoa, dude.
Yeah, do both.
I didn't know that about you.
Yeah, I played in a band called the New Sheridans, and if we had been good, we would have been in the ballpark of what No Doubt was doing.
Oh, wow. Like what year is that?
So that's 93, 94.
No Doubt era.
Around that No Doubt, yes. Wow. When we saw No Doubt, we realized, that's when I went, we're done. We're done.
Right.
Because radio, first of all, no one's going to have more than one of those. And also, there isn't more than one of her.
And she is special. I had that happen with a band. We got this gig playing out at UNLV. Because you said you saw No Doubt, and you're like, well, we're done because we can't hang with that.
Yeah.
For us, what happened is we were playing a show at UNLV, and the marching band came in, and they played Fire by Jimi Hendrix, the marching band.
Oh, my God.
And they destroyed us so bad, I was like, I quit.
Oh, my God.
I quit.
Wow. Oh, man.
So I can relate to that, too.
Yeah. We made a little 7-inch with Steve McDonald of Red Cross, and
That's cool.
But I was drinking a ton, and I was dating an actress, and she was had a boy. She was cheating, and it was just a bad. It was just awful. It was all falling apart.
So you're drinking a ton. You did some cool stuff with the band. You said you had great success in comedy away.
Like, in comedy, I was able to work pretty quickly. I was
to
able
make
to
make some money.
Yeah, I was able to be a host really quickly. I was able to just do it. And I'd made a lot of friends doing it. And that was, there was a core group of people that came down here around the same time that basically made up what they used to call the alternative comedy scene. Which
and who was that?
So Patton Oswalt, Brian Posehn, David Cross, you know, Odenkirk, Garofalo, you know, later on Sarah Silverman, like just that sort of, Doug Benson, like, you know, the people that would make Mr. Show and later on, like, comedy. Anyway, yeah, so...
Comedy Central stuff?
Yeah. But all the way like through Zach Galifianakis. Like, it was just this large group of people that came down and did stand-up. And not in the regular comedy clubs, but outside of that realm, because the comedy clubs originally didn't want to have us in there. So I also was auditioning for stuff. So I got in Jerry Maguire, and I got in, I did an episode of Wings, and then I got cut out of Jerry Maguire, and the band was doing poorly, and I was going through this horrible relationship thing, breakup.
The girl who's cheating with you.
Yeah,
cheating
but,
on you.
But when I say cheating, I can see cheating on me. I can see, she just didn't have the courage to break up with me because we lived together. But,
why could you see that?
Because I was aware of what a mess I was.
Okay, in what sense? Because your career-wise was doing okay.
Yeah, it was going okay, but I was, I mean...
You're how old at this point?
33.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. And why were you, you know, why is it okay to cheat on you? What was going on? You're drinking too much? Were you a pig? Were you cheating?
A little bit. No. But I just had super low self-esteem, you know,
I
was also like, I didn't really know who I was as a comic and and she was a comic as well. And I didn't really, like, I just really didn't have it together at all. And the band wasn't good. And also, I had a feeling they wanted me out. And what later on happened was they broke up the band and then got back together like an hour later without me, which I think was good for me to know that. And it was just messy. It was just, I was sad. I was crying. I felt like I would cry all the time. Like I just was like, I was done.
You'd cry all the time?
Yeah. I don't know why. I was just like from alcohol poisoning, from being, you know, it was one of those things.
So where's your drinking at this point? Like how much are you drinking
every
all day?
We're drinking all the time. Yeah, because we
wake up and drink.
Sometimes. Depends when I would wake up. But what it was like more is that like we'd all go do a show and then celebrate like we'd won an Emmy. Like it was just every night was just huge. And I was the person people called for parties and all, like I was the person who that's why people liked me. And I suddenly got
a sense of all of it. Other stuff too.
Like
maybe drugs?
Oh yes. Yeah. There was a lot of ecstasy and all that stuff. It was just whatever.
Yeah.
You know, it was just like, how can I not be the worse it got, how much further out can I get? How much further away from the truth can I get until it comes crashing back in the morning and then I got to push it away again?
Yeah.
Right. Because you're aware. Yeah. I'm aware. I was always aware. I never didn't think it was an alcoholism. I just didn't know how to, you know.
That's interesting. So how long did you go on knowing that you had a problem?
Probably. So on New Year's Eve, I was working at a comedy club, and I was...
what year?
This has got to be... It's open in 96, so 95.
Christmas,
yeah. New Year's Eve, 95, into 96.
We could have hung out and partied together.
It would have been good. Yeah, you would have liked it for a while, and then until I said, do you know where Janine is? Do you know where Janine is? No, I don't know where she is, dude. Why do you always talk about that? That's all I can think about.
Oh, your chick?
Yeah. We were doing stand-up together. It was me and her and a couple other people. And the
Janine Garofalo?
Yeah.
That was your girlfriend?
That was my girlfriend.
Oh, you're trying to slip by on that.
And I was like, you know. Yeah, no, I mean, I've talked about this before.
Sure.
And so the guy who ran the club was like, look, man. I put you on this bill because I think you're good and I think you should. I know that you guys are going through a thing. I think you should go on stage and try and blow her off stage every night. You know, it doesn't mean you're good, but like that. And I didn't do that. And on the show on New Year's Eve, I got so drunk I left the show. I don't remember where I just left.
Before you performed?
After I brought somebody up, I was supposed to then bring other people up. I just left.
You just bounced.
And they found me in the bushes somewhere.
Were you all just drunk and sad?
Kind
of. I did that stuff. I would just run away, get all mopey.
Yeah. Yeah. And so he's had me come down to the club on the second and said, you know, I thought you were going somewhere when I first started booking you here, but clearly you're just an alcoholic and you pissed on my club and I don't want you here again. So you're done. Don't ever come back here. And I was like, that's okay. It doesn't matter. I'm in a band.
Did you?
I'm in a band. You've ever heard the new Sheridans? Where
yeah.
It's about to happen for us.
Yeah.
So 6 months, you know, so that continued. That continued. And then on August 12th of 96, I woke up and I'd seen here's what happened. I'd gone to a taping of Mr. Show, and I saw a friend of mine who I used to drink with, who, like, he's the guy that you're like, I mean, I drink, but Richard's a
right.
drunk.
Richard who?
Richard R. Do you know Richard R.? He's a writer. I don't want to say because I don't know.
I know. Right?
But anyway, yeah, so I saw him at this taping of Mr. Show, and he looked really good. And I went, dude, what happened? And he goes, yeah. I'm sober. And I was like, you lost all that weight? And he's like, yeah. I was like, man, I gotta get sober, really, because I was,
right.
that was my thought.
The things that lure us in, right?
Yeah. And then it was probably 2 weeks after that, I woke up and went, I'm done. And I called him and I said, I gotta go to a meeting. And he goes, yeah. He looked at a thing. He goes, there's one down in Gower, the church on Gower at noon. And then I got up and I went to the meeting and I was like, oh, this is it. I came in like under arrest. Like I'm done.
Surrendered.
I don't care what happens here. I don't care what they talk about God. I don't care.
Right.
I really don't care. I'm a mess, man. I'm 33. Yeah. I can't tie my shoes. You know, my parents had been supporting me. I mean, it was, you know, and my roommate, who was David Cross at the time, you know, he came from nothing and had his own TV show and worked his way into that, like would stay home and write instead of going out. And I just was like, man, I got my priorities, you know, and also
you were going out all the time. Yeah.
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 Because that's what I did. That was sort of my thing, you know.
I get it. Yeah. The powerlessness, you know.
Yeah. And I was sick and I just was and I was 33. I was like, man, there's not going to be, you know, your window in show business is short.
The window's closing. Yeah.
So
how did you ever get like suicidal thoughts or were you in a depression? Like how dark were those days before you surrendered? Sounds like you got given the gift of desperation.
Yeah. I think, you know, the recklessness with which I was living my life would, like if a bus had hit me, I'd have been okay with it. Somebody had taken me. I did start pushing people sometimes when I was going to get a piece of pizza. I remember in Berkeley, guy bumped me and I shoved him. Maybe I bumped him first. And I just wanted him to slug me.
Yeah.
I think I just was at a point where I wanted some conflict. You know,
yeah.
I wanted something. And I also, there was a part of me, because of the people I ran with were drank so hard, you know, at a certain point I was like, I had no gauge and I was afraid to leave the pack.
Mm-hmm.
Because I knew if I left the pack, I'd lose the friends, which I did.
Mm.
But I had to make a choice, and that was what happened.
I feel like that part when you're talking about shoving somebody, and, you know, that seems like it's from hurt, because I can relate to that.
Yeah.
When you're just so sick of being hurt, and not that you're necessarily a victim, but for some reason we're hurting.
But
you can't hold it in anymore.
I don't know how to ask for help.
Yeah.
If I make a scene here, somebody's going to have to come get me.
Mm.
Somebody's got to come. You know what I mean? If I get punched, I feel like I don't know how to just say to somebody, help me. And I don't want to tell my friends and I don't want to tell my parents. And I go inward and I decide nobody is going to help me. That isn't true. I never sought out anybody. So I don't know if that's true or not, but that's my version of it.
It's interesting how the emotions manifest, right? We're
yeah.
hurting. We have all that volatility. We're shoving it down. We don't know how to ask for help. Not that we wouldn't have got it. And then now we're acting out. The anger is coming out. The sadness is coming out.
Right.
And we almost don't.
It isn't fun anymore. And also when I isolate, and also when I would get drugs and I would just go be by myself. Like it became that kind of thing of like, But then there's always, for me, there's always been a God sitting out there going, what are we doing now? What's the plan? Like, I always feel like, God's always right there going, okay, I'll wait. So you're going to, okay, is that what we're doing now? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Here we go. Like, I had a sense of it always that there was somebody watching over, and that's the best way to describe it. But, and I've always had a belief in something, you know, that wasn't me. Because I could feel it sometimes where I go, well, this is an unusual feeling and it feels very good. But I didn't know I didn't know how it came about. But it was usually when something happened that I didn't plan on or that I wasn't seeking for myself usually.
Yeah.
You know,
and I like what you said, which I totally forgot what I was going to say. So, but that's okay. Let's play a song now, since I can't think straight.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm digging the story. Oh, no. I was going to say, our stories are very similar in that, like, it was partying at first. And then it turns into loneliness and isolation. You feel like you're doing the same thing, and all of a sudden it's not a party anymore. It's miserable and desperate.
Right. But you still have the story about yourself that you're a fun guy.
Mm-hmm.
But you have, there's less people around, and not that many people believe that anymore. Are you that fun? You don't seem like you're that fun.
So do we have another replacement song?
No, what do we pick? Oh, wait, we couldn't use the one song. Which one?
Factory.
Oh, Factory. Oh, I just love this song. Here's why I like this song, and it's a slow, mellow jam. But my daughters are the greatest thing that ever happened. I'm sure people say that all the time on here. But they love music, and my daughters and I go to shows together, and one of their favorite bands is Band of Horses. And so I just love this song.
We love Band of Horses.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
This is Wes Geer on Rock to Recovery Radio with my guest, Greg Behrendt, and this is Band of Horses.
Don't
Band of Horses rules. This is Wes Geer, and we're on Rock to Recovery Radio, KX93.5 FM, Laguna's only FM station, Human Crafted Radio. And this is also brought to you by New Vista Behavioral Health. I told you guys I was tired of napping before the show, so it's a little hard getting the words out the mouth. We're here with comedian, writer, Greg Barrett, telling his story.
Yeah.
From being kind of a normal kid, going through it, some insecurities, but you're doing all right, some incidences in drinking, but you came from the Bay Area to L.A. You had a band. That maybe didn't work out, but comedy was going great. You're dating Janine Garofalo, and you really weren't at the height of self-esteem.
Right.
And that was crashing and burning. You got fired from your comedy gig.
I got fired. Yes.
Yeah. And then that just brought it all home, right?
It was all snowballing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so, like, you know, I came in on just an order. Like, it was just a night. It was just another in a series of nights where I woke up and went, I just am done. You know, I do remember when I woke up, the first thought was, you're going to die.
Mm.
And this is not what we had planned for you.
This is not sustainable.
Yeah. And I also thought, this isn't who you are. Like, there was a voice that was like, this is not who you are. This is not who you become. And it all sort of, I mean, it's funny when you talk about a thought, it occurs so three-dimensionally that you try and put it in words, but it was a lot of things happening at once, and a fear that I was going to die, and also that I had let people down, and that I let myself down, and I needed to be something else.
Yeah.
You know, and when I walked into the first meeting over on Gower, I felt like, oh my God, I've been waiting for these people forever. Like,
you heard yourself in there.
Yeah, I loved it. I did. I mean, I saw lots of different people, but they were, you know, it's Hollywood, so a lot of them were cool, and a lot of them were, they were just different. It wasn't just what I'd known from maybe attending a meeting some point,
like when I
was in high school or somewhere where I went to after high school, but it was like a, you know, group of old men sitting in a circle.
So, you had that gift of desperation. You found your people.
Yeah.
And then you said in the break, you said you stayed sober 15 years?
Yeah, 15 years. And the first five, I did it, you know, I did my commitments, and I did it exactly the way you do it. I had a sponsor right away. I went through the steps really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I loved it. I loved the whole deal. And then my life got incredibly good, you know,
Incredibly good? Was that the Sex and the City gig, a wifey poo?
Everything just started to happen, you know, like
felt good.
My stand-up started to move. I got an HBO special. I met my wife around that time. You know, we had a really cool thing going on.
Everything in your life was better than it had ever been, right? Because you got more success in career. You're not drinking. This program of recovery.
Yeah, and I was open to different ideas. Amir was different than the people I dated. My career, you know, a lot of my, you know, I ended up working on Sex and the City, which is a show that was
massive.
But among my peers was like, man, it's not that cool, man. You know, it's whatever. But I really enjoyed it. I just found I found myself being really comfortable being me.
Yeah.
And I started to get a sense of who I really am and what I really have to offer. And the job at Sex and City, I was just a consultant. I was not a writer. So that means I just came in and gave my 2 cents when people asked for it. So I found that, like, rather than pontificating, I was better being, you know, when people ask you a question. You know, that's part of the thing of recovery is, like, I can't tell you what to do, but if you have a question for me, I might have an answer or know someone who does.
Or share your experience, your strength, your hope.
Right. But I have to listen to you.
Hmm.
I can't not listen to you.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't listen to anybody for a long time. And then eventually I thought, man, I need to start listening to people.
Yeah. So you get desperate enough to hear other ideas.
Well, your life is telling you what it wants to if you listen close enough. It's trying to get you to go places. You're like, oh, I don't know if that's really my thing. Just come over here. I promise you.
Yeah. And that's key for me, too, in meditation, is to stop and listen.
Yeah.
You know, be guided. So we only have a few minutes left, but I wanted to get into, you also shared after 15 years, you stopped doing your recovery program.
Yep.
And you started getting dark again, I think.
What happened is, after success, there is sometimes a lack of success, right? I mean, you know, everything hits a sort of a peak, and then after the peak, and anyone will tell you, you know, 1 minute everybody wants to call you, and then when that phone stops, it stops. I mean, it almost like the phone goes, oh, we're done.
Yeah.
And then you're like, oh, okay. And I struggled with that, and I didn't have a sponsor. I wasn't going to meetings regularly, and I thought I could just outthink it. And I started to realize I was struggling with some depression issues, and they started to get wonky. And the next thing you know, I'm using new coping mechanisms, like, hey, the dog's hydrocodone might work, and you know, that kind of thing. So, yeah, and it was a complete lack of a program and of connection, you know.
You said you were taking some other meds for yourself.
Yeah, I mean
besides doggy codone.
Yes, well, what happened was, then I went to rehab, and I got that solved, and then I tried to work my way back into my family, who were very disappointed in me, and I went on the road, and I got sober again, but I was on the road a lot, and so I'd go to meetings, but not as much as I could. I was in Australia, then I was in New York, then I was in Australia, and in Australia, I discovered I had cancer. I had a non-Hodgkin's B-cell lymphoma in my intestines, whatever, and they had to send me back home, and they put me on OxyContin, which... then, because of the way that the surgery went and the recovery, I was on it for months and months, 6 months, and I had trouble getting off of it.
That's incredible. And I was just talking to somebody about this, who's actually a nurse and a friend of mine. What people don't understand is, it doesn't matter how long you have sober, or even if you have a program that's helping you, when you take a drug, prescribed or not, it can set off that allergy, that phenomenon of craving. You know,
well,
that makes you want more and more and more.
The other thing is, I think the thing that I always try to explain to people was, you know, even when I took the hydrocodone, I was trying not to be crazy. I just didn't want to kill myself.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't looking for a good time. Same with the Oxy. I just didn't want the coming off of the withdrawal is nightmarish.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in a way that's like, I don't know if I can live through it. Painful. And it is dark, and you go to a depression you didn't know existed. Like, there's depths you haven't been to, and you're like, I can't. And that's why I think people, and also, how did I get here? I did what the doctor said. This was how many I was supposed to take a day. Then they give you 12, you know, they give you a handful of Norcos to get off it. It doesn't work. A guy just gave a TED talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't know what to do, and you start going, I got to do a show tonight. Now I'm out on the road, and I'm withdrawing. And so I grab one from a guy. I get somebody who grab anything,
just to
an
get
opiate.
Normal.
That's
kinda.
It. And that's all you're doing. You're just, you know, you're doing that until you can figure it out. Finally, I went to my psychiatrist and said, I did the Suboxone thing. And then I went to a meeting after that.
And now how long do you have?
And now I've got almost 2 years.
Good for you, Ben.
Yeah.
Congratulations. You're such a neat dude. You have such a great energy.
Oh, that's nice of you to say.
Yeah. So
not everybody feels that way. I would love you to tell my wife about my neat energy.
Well, you've been through a lot, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So tell me about how what's amazing about your life now and what's key for you.
Well, I've taken it to the, you know, meditation is a big part of it.
Yeah,
right?
Same.
So I get up, and that's the first thing I do, because I want to start right away with the, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know who's coming to visit this morning, but I'm going to go ahead and beat them at the path.
Yeah.
Get into some breathing, into something like that. And then I read from the book, and then I go to I live right by a meeting. I go to the 9 o'clock by my house. Almost every morning I go down there. I've got friends. I have a community. You know, I mean, I really had to build it up from nothing. When I was done, I lost everything. So, I have that. And then I take commitments, and I challenge myself to try different things. And I try and answer the phone. It takes me some hour time, but I've sponsored a guy now, and I've been through the steps, and I like it. And it is the first thing of my life. It's the top priority.
Yeah,
and it was always sort of top, maybe not top thing, and now it is the top thing. And when it is, even if people aren't always pleased about it in the moment, in the long run, they like the result.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So now I also enjoy it, and it makes my I think what you were talking about earlier, like about how you have more fun, you have to redefine what fun is.
Exactly.
My old version of fun was waking up in Palm Desert, having started in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
My version of fun now is not crying. But also just like being aware, spending time with it just takes so little for me to be okay, you know, and to be surprised, because I don't know what's going to happen next, and I'm trying not to know.
Yeah. I love it. Redefining what fun is when you're in those dark places, just hanging out with dad doesn't feels so great. But when you're in that good spot, you can really go, man, it's just cool to hang with my dad.
Yeah, and this is it. It's the thing that's happening now. Right, as opposed to, because all of your problems, if they're not happening right now, they haven't happened yet. And you don't really actually know what's going to happen next. So they may not actually be there. But if you spend a lot of time telling people about your problems, they're like, yeah, dude, I like that guy, but
that's enough.
Yeah, and then I tell you something. The older you get, the more people are like, that story should be over for him. He should not be talking like that. You know, that's that guy. And you're like, oh.
Well, dude, it's so cool that you came down here. And that made me think, too, then that means at the holiday show, you had about a year.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow, that's even cooler to know the backstory of it. So I really, really appreciate you coming down here.
Dude, it was a blast.
I hope you're not lying, but who cares?
No, I'm not lying. No, I really enjoyed it. I really enjoy you. This is really very cool. I mean, you don't get to do this that often.
No, we don't. I'm with you. It means a lot, and I know you probably helped a lot of people out there. Like I said, thanks for coming down. Thanks for bringing your dad and sharing your story.
Yeah, man.
And we're doing this little Rock to Recovery concert on September 15th at the Fonda Theater in Hollywood. We're honoring Moby, hosted by my friend Brian Fogel, who just won an Academy Award for his film Icarus, and Steel Panther's headlining.
Oh, nice.
What people don't know is we're also honoring Tommy Vext of Bad Wolves. It's a sober event.
Oh, that's nice.
And we have A-list talent. We'll have red carpet and, you know, celebs. And I would love it if you could come down. I don't know. You might be busy. I know you're a busy dude.
I might be free. Let's talk about it.
But love to see you there. But more importantly, thank you so much for sharing your heart and soul here on Rock to Recovery Radio. Thanks for everybody that tuned in to Rock to Recovery Radio. This has been an interview with Greg Barrett, and I'm your host, Wes Gear. And remember, if you're out there struggling, you don't have to do it alone. There's people like Greg and I and just millions of people all over the world that would love nothing less than to hear what you're going through and help you find a solution. So thanks for tuning into Rock to Recovery Radio, and we're out.